This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, May 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
For more than 30 years, Ayatollah Khamenei has exerted near absolute control over the Iranian government and the daily lives of citizens. But he now faces an unprecedented series of crises. In January, Qasem Soleimani, leader of the elite intelligence service called the Quds Force and Khamenei's right-hand man, was assassinated in an American drone strike. The next month, the coronavirus began to ravage the country. As the death toll mounted and the country's economy, already decimated by sanctions, virtually collapsed, government officials told the public that there was nothing to worry about. In a televised speech on April 9th, Khamenei praised the country's efforts to combat the virus. He said, "The Iranian nation had a brilliant performance in this test. The people's cooperation has also created beautiful, fascinating, and astonishing scenes, and they can be seen everywhere." Dexter Filkins, a New Yorker staff writer, traveled to Iran in February before anyone outside the regime knew the extent of the pandemic within the country. He joins me to talk about his discussions with doctors who've been treating infected patients and journalists who've been censored, his clandestine meetings with leading dissidents, and what Iran might look like when Khamenei is gone. Dexter, welcome back.
Hi.
You've been trying to get into Iran for years, initially wanting to write a piece about the twilight of the Iranian Revolution, and then you suddenly got your visa this February, and then you ended up writing this story that reads like a political thriller. But I wanted to ask, first of all, why you were so suddenly summoned at a particularly peculiar time, it seems, to invite an American investigative reporter into the country.
I don't know what happened. I've been, as you said, I've been applying for years. They always tell you the same thing, which is it's a very bad time right now. Come back in a few months. And I've been doing that over and over and over again. And now's a really bad time. And in February it was a really bad time. And for reasons that I can't understand. You know, the black box, which is the Iranian government, it just, the visa popped out of it. And they called me one morning and said, "Your visa's ready. It starts tomorrow. It's for 6 days. So you better hurry." So I ran out the door.
And then, you know, when you got there, you had some extraordinary conversations with doctors and other Iranians about the virus.
Yeah. I mean, the coronavirus was sort of was slowly unfolding as a problem. I mean, the government was very busy reassuring people that even though it was very close by in China, it wasn't a problem. And yet everybody on the streets was kind of whispering and worrying. And this is the way life is in a totalitarian system. You know, the government says A, and then everybody starts whispering about B and C and D. And so people were really worried. What I subsequently learned was pretty shocking. In a couple of interviews that I did with doctors in the northern city of Gorgan, they saw the virus in December. They didn't know what the virus was. They just know how they had these people coming in. They were very sick and they were dying very quickly. And first it was one and then it was two. And then they started coming in droves. And I remember one doctor said to me, so many people were dying that we had to lease a backhoe to dig pits at the cemetery. And as the doctors were kind of stunned, they were reporting this up their chain of command and saying, "We're getting this very strange disease. And then by January and February, it's coronavirus. We have a diagnosis. Please help us." Basically, the word that was coming back down from the top was, "Keep your mouth shut. In fact, don't even wear masks or any kind of protective gear because that'll make people panic."
Why were they covering it up?
Well, it appears February 19th was the nationwide parliamentary elections. They wouldn't let me stay for the elections. The day before I left, the government finally announced that two Iranians had died from the coronavirus. And it's absolutely clear, and I think it's been pretty well established by some documents that have leaked out of the government, that the reason why the Iranian government was suppressing all the information was because they were worried that if people knew the coronavirus was out there, they wouldn't go out and vote.
Khamenei is 80 years old, said to be in bad health, and many of his closest advisors have been infected by COVID-19.
Well, it's Khamenei's life is fascinating, and if you trace his life and his rise and his career, you can pretty much track the arc of the Iranian Revolution. And so, you know, once, you know, 30 years ago, he was a young man and full of energy and full of idealism. And today in Iran, essentially, he is his government himself. It's a government of old men who many years ago made a revolution. And you can sort of see that and feel it, that the revolution is kind of old and it feels like it's out of energy. So you have Khamenei is 80 years old. He's old, he's frail, he's been sick, he's a cancer survivor. And the most powerful institution in the country is arguably the Revolutionary Guards. And so what I tried to do in the course of my piece was kind of pose the question, what happens when Khamenei leaves the scene?
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a second. But I first wanted to ask you about Soleimani, whom you wrote about a couple of years ago. He was the one the U.S. assassinated in January. Tell us about his relationship with Khamenei and how the killing has affected Iran.
Soleimani was quite extraordinary. When I wrote about him a few years ago, it was as the sort of the visionary and the chief executor of Iran's foreign policy. But domestically, he had a role as well. He was so close to Khamenei, many people said to me, the supreme leader saw him like a son. And, you know, we know Soleimani from his actions in foreign policy and across the Middle East. And, you know, whether it's in terrorism or assassinations or, you know, propping up Bashar al-Assad. But he was also instrumental in putting down some of the really big domestic rebellions inside Iran. And so what was really interesting to me was it became clear that Khamenei, the supreme leader, he really wanted his son, Mujtaba, to succeed him. I think that's pretty clear. And it looked like the person who was going to run that succession and kind of make that happen would be Soleimani. And suddenly Soleimani's gone. And I think that was a real body blow to the regime, but also to the kind of any expectation that we can have about how the succession to Khamenei is going to play out. Because the person who is going to kind of make that happen, who the supreme leader trusted more than anyone, is gone.
You went to a couple of gatherings, and at one, your host told you that public confidence in the theocratic system has just collapsed.
That was certainly my impression. It's so hard when you're not there for very long. And I had a minder during the day, which is to say a government employee who would kind of follow me around and make sure I didn't talk to anybody interesting. So I had to kind of sneak out at night to meet people who were brave enough to meet me and kind of and speak freely. And so it's very difficult to get a sense of the place, but just moving around town and talking to people and, you know, going into shops and like even going, I was there for the anniversary, I think it was the 41st anniversary of the revolution. I just didn't see it. It's only Tehran. It's the capital. I mean, it's a huge city, my gosh. But I felt like this is just my gut speaking, but it felt like the revolution is out of gas.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You know, some of your most remarkable conversations were with Iranian women who have challenged the regime in various ways. And I thought you could tell us a little bit about Sarah, who cited Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale to give you a sense of their lives.
Yes.
And she said, this is the real Gilead.
Sarah was amazing and inspiring, and you know, I wish I could have written the whole piece about her and had a big photograph of her, but it was very dangerous for her to meet me, and she was very, very nervous, and I was too. I was nervous for her. She had come from this group of women. This is an amazing story. This group of women who, for years, women and girls, have been dressing up like boys and painting mustaches on their faces so that they could get into football games, because women were never allowed into to watch football games. And this became this kind of quite unusual and remarkable protest movement. And she had a lot of friends, people around her who were part of that movement. And not very long ago, just several months ago, the Iranian regime, under international pressure, finally agreed during one game to allow women to sit in the end zone. Sarah went, and she described it to me and said, we walked in and we, you know, it was nothing, but, you know, we saw the pitch and the green grass and we all started crying. And she was amazing. And she said, look, this is The Handmaid's Tale. And I should say that I was quite pleased to see yesterday that Margaret Atwood had evidently read the story and tweeted it on her Twitter account. I sent Sarah a message on Signal, the encrypted app, and I said, I think she heard you. And Sarah was very pleased.
And her comments to you were just extraordinary. She told you, you know, the women of this country are not going to stop. I am absolutely prepared to go to prison. And then she said, the problem they have with us is that if women get power, they're going to take them down. That is the fact. They're going to overthrow the government.
It's incredible. It's incredible. I felt like, I mean, I've met people like this before in these kind of, they kind of emerge from these really oppressive societies. She is brave, she's poised, she's determined, and she's remarkably young. But I felt like I was sitting across from Václav Havel or Andrei Sakharov, totally brave, totally committed, with an absolutely clear sense of kind of where the country was and where she was in that country and kind of in the greater world, and a larger sense of her rights as a human being. Just really stunning.
You also spoke with Faiza Rafsanjani, a former member of parliament and also the daughter of a late president. What did she have to say?
Faiza was remarkable. I mean, just, and the amazing thing about Faiza was it's all there on the record in her name. She is completely brave, and she's the daughter of the former president, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who kind of was a huge figure in the history of the revolution. He's now dead. And what's amazing about Faiza is that beginning in the 1990s and then through the 2000s and then kind of culminating with the Green Movement in 2009, Faiza has become one of the principal dissidents in the country and the most vocal and the most outspoken. And in that way, it's damning of the regime that here is the daughter of the former president and one of the pillars of the revolution. And she is utterly critical of the regime and totally fearless. And I think she probably has some protection, or at least you think that, because of her family connections. But then you remember she's been to prison three times. And what she said to me at the end, as right before I left the country, she said, look, here's the situation that we're in. This regime, it has lost all popular support. And yet at the same time, it is incapable of change. And the result of that is that the Iranian people have lost all hope. We are hopeless.
The leadership, you know, which loves to use the United States and Israel as whipping boys, people like Rafsanjani just refuse to listen to that. You know, she thinks that that's just a pathetic excuse for the regime's failure to reform. What about the succession to Khamenei? You show in your piece that the regime is really badly threatened from within. And does the leadership recognize this at all?
It's the $64,000 question. And it's one everybody's talking about. It's a full-on police state. Nobody talks about publicly, but everybody talks about privately. What is going to happen when Khamenei dies? You know, there's a kind of succession that's written down on paper. It's kind of like when the Pope dies, here's what's supposed to happen. Pretty much everyone I spoke to who had kind of an independent voice felt like it wouldn't go that way, that it would be a much more kind of informal and unpredictable process. And so the question is, does it get out of control? And I had this one fascinating conversation with, I couldn't use his name in the story, but he was very close to many people in the government, very close to people in the Revolutionary Guards. And he said, I'm very worried. The struggle to succeed Khamenei has already begun. And he said, my concern is that over 30 years, Khamenei has personalized the system. He has appointed everyone. He said he knows the names of, you know, junior commanders in the Revolutionary Guards, and he knows the names of their children. He said it's like a solar system, and Khamenei is the sun. And so he said, what happens to the solar system when you take the sun away? That's the concern. The concern is, there was a Western diplomat who's quoted in the piece who said to me, I think it's a 24-hour decision. In other words, if it doesn't happen in 24 hours, that means there's a problem.
So, Dexter, before I let you go, I have to ask you about your own interrogation by the IRG as you were heading home, which was rather dramatic.
Yes. So it was my last day in the country. It was the day before the elections. And just by happenstance, I was talking to one of those Western diplomats, and I told him I was leaving. I'm on my way to the airport. And he said, there are two checkpoints at the airport. It's the second one you need to worry about. That's the Revolutionary Guards. So sure enough, I went to the airport, and on my way to the airport.
Wait, you must have had to like wipe clean, know, your
took everything off, phone. stripped my phone completely of everything. All the encrypted apps, email, everything. There was nothing on my phone. Just like the diplomat said, I breezed through that first checkpoint and then I got to the second one. And as I was standing outside the X-ray machine waiting for my backpack to come through, I felt a hand on my shoulder. And a very big guy said to me, we have some questions for you. And so they brought me into this room that was, it wasn't much bigger than a walk-in closet. And there were six of them. And they were big, and no one was smiling. And it was so cramped in there that our knees were touching. And of course, which is just the way they wanted it. And there was one guy that did the questioning, and he said, we've been watching you. We know that you've been going into restricted areas. You've been photographing restricted sites. You've been talking to people without permission. And I just freaked out. I thought, oh my God, not for me, but they've been following me. They're going to know every Iranian I met privately at night, and they're going to go pick all them up. And that was my greatest fear. And as the course of the long interview went on, it became pretty clear to me they didn't know what I had done. And they were kind of fishing, and they were trying to intimidate me. And at one point, I kind of handed them my phone and said, take a look. And they took my phone away. They took it out of the room. They kept it for a while. They brought it back. They no doubt scanned it. And there was this kind of strange moment where my interrogator seemed to get a little embarrassed, and he didn't quite apologize, but he handed my phone back and said, okay, I believe you. Have a nice flight. And I went
to that. They're not quite as all powerful as one would believe.
Well, it was kind of where malevolence is trumped by incompetence, but I thought the plane had left, but it was waiting for me all along.
I'm glad you made it back safe and sound. Thank you so much, Dexter.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War, about the U.S. battle against Islamic fundamentalism in Afghanistan and Iraq. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.